Okay, this is The View from Tab. I'm Jim Menick.
I'm John Cruz.
I'm Mike Beats.
Why have we decided that that's the order anyhow? Because we never talked about that. Anyhow, the three of us are here, and we are going to talk about Fury in debate.
Which... It sounds like you're saying eerie.
Theory is eerie. Okay, just to give people background, we wanted to talk about this for whatever reason, and Mike and John both sent me some files today that were, they looked to me like full-blooded cases, because it was like two pages, and they're negative positions, so two pages is a full-blooded negative position, which were theories, theory arguments about why I want to whine in the most specific way possible that I shouldn't have to debate this round. So that is my initial take on theory, but I have a feeling that there's a better take somewhere. So
maybe not.
I mean, here's my question. Okay, like one of the pieces that I got was, and we talked about this at my meeting with my team last night, which was, can you argue on November, December, which is the immunization topic, can you argue a specific instance of, you know, a public health concern requiring compulsory immunization and have that be a case, which is something we talked about, the three of us talked about a couple of weeks ago. And my feeling was that, yes, you probably could do this, but of course you had to demonstrate some kind of underlying rationale for why this is doable. So, some philosophical or ethical reason why this would be okay. And then I'm reading whatever you want to call it, the position, which was exactly about this, which is saying that if in fact the affirmative runs a specific instance rather than just this thing in general. I mean, this was the way I read this. So you run a specific instance. Since the negative can't know what that instance is going to be, it's unfair to the negative because the negative can't have prepared on that specific thing. And therefore, the affirmative ought to lose because they're bullying, essentially, the negative from the position of knowing what they're going to run, which the negative can't know. I mean, am I wrong on that? Is that the situation?
I think that that's probably right. I think that the way that we wrote it was more about, I think, the definition of compulsory. I think that we said that. I think we would run it specific to how healthcare workers, I think we just argued that since a healthcare worker can choose whether or not they want to be a healthcare worker, it wasn't really compulsory. So that it wouldn't meet the definition of compulsory. That might be one of the ones that I sent. The other one probably had to do with parametricizing whether or not the affirmative, whether or not the affirmative has the ability to carve out a specific instance of compulsory immunization and, say that that's enough for an affirmation of the resolution.
Now, the position isn't that, the negative isn't going to run this all the time, right? I mean, there's only going to be in certain situations.
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily the case that the theory argument has to be true in order to win with it. I mean, it's a matter of showing off your debate skills, I guess, right? That would be the case. It's just like lawyering, right? That if you're debating over whether or not evidence was properly obtained by the police, or whether or not testimony should be allowed, or whether
Okay, but I'm the judge now in this round. I mean, I am looking at the words, or I have the words in my head to what the resolution is. Now, this particular resolution cannot, in any way, shape, or form, be interpreted as all public health concerns always require compulsory immunization. So, I mean, immediately I have to determine that some public, I mean, you know, I mean, first of all, there has to be an immunization for the public health concerns. I can't have the, you know, like STD, you know, like AIDS, for instance, can't require immunization because there is no immunization. So, I mean, there is no universality that all public health concerns have to always, lead to compulsory immunization. So at the point where there's no way that it could be all, it has to be some. I mean, this is just the logic of the words. I mean, I know what those words
mean. Yeah, and that's what the affirmative could argue back. That there's no way that could be reached, and they could, you know, provide a counter standard and something about
whether or not we should be immunized at that point. They're arguing about the definitions of the words, which are as clear as day. I mean, these are not radically diverse interpretable words. I mean, these are very clear words that very clearly lead to a fairly straightforward interpretation.
I think that you could talk to a lot of even traditionalist LD judges that would say it is not okay to just pick one example of compulsory immunization and defend that, because that's not what LD is about. LD isn't about specific things. It's about
general
rules.
I grant you that you can't just say that only in this case. What you have to do, what the affirmative has to do is say, here, first of all, there are general principles that say that the need of the group overrides the needs of the individual, which is sort of, you know, what this
sort of Mr. Spock, actually.
Yeah,
but okay.
Exactly. So what is the Spock quote anyhow? Is that it?
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Yeah, okay. So
or the one.
Which has always been a better definition of utilitarianism than the greatest good for the greatest number. But anyhow, so the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, which is a really good way to look at this. So I have to demonstrate that that's true, and I'm going to use examples to demonstrate it. I shouldn't be beholden to say that it's true in every situation of public health, you know, that it has to be true. But if, in fact, I think it is the affirmative's job to demonstrate that there is an underlying principle involved. Absolutely. So they can't just say, well, this case is very weird, but this case requires it, and therefore I win. I mean, certainly I don't buy that by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't think I need to run a whole theory, you know, two-page case to respond to that. I mean, that's part of my thing here. It's just like I don't understand why I have to go off.
Well, because if... Let's say someone is running something hyper-specific, like just healthcare workers, and you don't really have anything to say to healthcare workers, because who's going to disagree that healthcare workers shouldn't be immunized, right? They work with sick people, etc. Or even something even more specific and even
right,
more...
healthcare workers in a specific...
For example, someone ran a case that says that we should immunize babies who are not born yet, who have mothers that are HIV positive in South Africa, right? Who's going to have evidence on that? No one's going to have evidence on that.
But the affirmative job is to relate that to an underlying principle.
Well, let's say they don't do their job, and they say, let's just do this.
No, then I agree with you, but my question...
Well, isn't what you're saying that if they don't do that, then you don't need to have... I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but if is what you're trying to say that if they don't prove the underlying principle, then that should be sufficient for the
exactly.
judge to say I'm not going to vote for you.
Yeah, the idea that people are going to go into a debate,
but you have to,
with bizarre
but you have
examples is as old as the hills.
Exactly.
And you just say that's a bizarre example; it doesn't work. And here's
but
the
what's
reason
the
it
standard
work.
For a bizarre example? I mean, the fact that there's a structure to what a quote unquote theory violation, I think, is a good thing. Right, that you have to provide some standard as to what a quote-unquote typical example would be, that it's based, you know, that there are a number of standards for that it's based in the topic literature, that it's...
It's sort of ironic on some level that there is such a structure.
That it's based in definitions, that it's based in, you know, any number of things, and that, you know, that if you prove that it's based in those things, then you can talk about it. But if you don't, then there's a reason why you shouldn't, whether it's fairness or education or competitive equity, you know, any number of things that you would tell the judge, this is why you should I mean, to me, that sounds less than a, like less than a wine than this is a bizarre example. That but sounds, I mean, I, to me, that sounds more like a wine.
I see what you're saying. Okay. But what are, how do we establish what the standards are for, you know, like normal cases to be run on anything? I mean, you talk, I mean, what is that standard?
I don't know. I mean, if we, I would say that if it's something where we wouldn't have good case evidence against, it's probably not normal. If it's something that, you know, that if in looking like, you know, I don't know. I struggle. I was actually thinking about this on my way home today, that one of the things that people against a lot of things like coach involvement and, you know, coaches helping write cases or writing cases or whatever, is that they didn't want to harm the creativity of the students. Yet, you know, on this topic, I see a lot of kids actually being creative about, you know, what it means to compulsory immunize and find, like, digging deep. And, you know, one person's digging deep and being creative is another person's, well, that's just bizarre and weird. We shouldn't, it's not part of the topic. So I think it's a fine line between the two things. And I guess I would err on the side of let the kids be creative and, you know, let's learn about these different things. I know more about H1N1, H1N5, which I guess is SARS and cowpox and black tongue than I ever knew before before we started debating this resolution. So,
see, I guess what I'm thinking is, okay, the affirmative gets up there and they bring up whatever cases they want and whatever instances, you know, whatever examples they want to bring up. Now, if it's an example I haven't heard of, I'm not, this isn't policy. I don't have to respond to the specific example. What I have to respond to is what that example means and what they're deriving, what the impact of that example is. And it doesn't really matter. I mean, I guess this is what I'm thinking, that it ought not to matter what that specific example is, because either they are saying, well, here's a good reason to override, you know, individual autonomy.
Right.
And if they, and I'm going to say, look, this example, whatever it is, and I don't care what the example is, doesn't demonstrate that. And I don't think I necessarily have to have a medical degree, and I don't have to have all that much research in that particular issue to be able to do that. And at that point, I'm still arguing as a debater about the resolution. I guess
I want to jump in and say that I think that relates to sort of a larger issue, and perhaps, you know, outside the domain of just talking about theory, that I've noticed popping up, particularly on some recent discussions on LDDebate.org, where it seems like, you know, we went through this phase where obviously, you know, I guess in the olden days, quote unquote, analytics, cases consisted primarily of analytics, and now we have we have cases where people really do have very policy-like cases where it's mostly, you know, tag card kind of thing. And it's interesting because there's some discussions on LDDebate.org right now where people really I think are sort of just trashing analytics, and it's interesting that that there are some people who maybe don't directly say it, but it would seem that they can't conceive of situations in which analytics could really take out very well warranted evidence, right? And I think that points to what Jim is talking about.
Well, I agree that there are people that don't give enough credence to analytics, but mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that that's false. I think that, you know, that we should be debating about logic and arguments and those sorts of things. But
well,
I think
what do you
that
think all, is false? I'm confused what you mean by
that. Well,
false.
I think that it's false that can't be the case, that a good analytic argument could tell.
Oh, yeah, it's completely false. I agree.
But I suppose it depends what's trying to be proven. I mean, if it's a statistic or it's something empirical, then it's tough to...
Well, I'm sorry. Let me just say one quick thing. I just think if people walk into rounds with that belief that it's like you must have the evidence, or, you know, the evidence is going to... well-warranted evidence is going to trump everything, and you have no hope of responding to it. That I think is the, you know, we talk about all these things that will lead to problems in LD and resource poor programs, etc. I mean, that mentality I think is what really starts to damage the ability for a debater who isn't heavily coached or doesn't have the ability to cut tons of evidence. I mean, that, I think that's the real problem, right? And I mean, I guess it's a little off topic, but it just what Jim said reminded me of.
Well, I mean, you're at the borderline. Well, I mean, that's what theory policy.
I mean, that's what theory can help combat, though. I mean, theory argumentation is something where you don't need a lot of resources. I mean, it's where the lone debater can get, you know, if you're a very good theory debater, you don't need to carry around specific evidence to every single type
this
of affirmative
is
case.
Exactly what we used to hear about critiques, which is, okay, you're going to have critiques because, you know, it's unfair. And this goes back to the policy where critiques are invented because you have a big program. They have a lot of evidence. They got a new program that doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of evidence. So they come up with a critique as a defense against having somebody else having a lot of evidence. And then LD borrows or steals the concept of critique, not for the same reason whatsoever, but to simply run a short circuit negative. So I can have a Nietzsche critique that I can run against everything. So I get to write one case when I'm a freshman, and I can run it now for the next 4 years. With any luck, it'll work because it's clever. And it shows why I don't have to debate. And now, instead of calling it a critique, because these really weren't critiques, these were just off-case, off-resolution things that were tricky, but they tended to work. In a way, and I don't think this is true of all theory, and I don't want to make that stretch, but nonetheless, theory has now replaced the critique as a way of getting around actually arguing resolution. And not to put too fine a point on it, we're living in a country now that is absolutely arguing about whether or not we should get immunizations, about a disease that is keeping kids from coming to my tournament, that has killed people in John's school district. Okay,
That's exactly right. And how do you vote against that? I mean, the affirmative is going to win every single round. I was talking to Josh Anderson at lunch today, and he said, I don't understand how the affirmatives are winning, or how the negatives win any rounds, because the affirmative is just true. How, I mean, if you're running a case about children, children don't have autonomy like adults do. Children, you know, how do you, I mean, it's so overwhelmingly affirmative biased. That the negative has all the negative can really do is rely on an autonomy argument or tricks.
Okay, you're right. I mean, unless you take the arguments into areas which are not what I just said with incredible venom, well, because there are areas where it is, in fact, a one-on-one situation. I mean, the measles vaccine being the perfect example. It's a one-on-one situation. It's me protecting myself versus, you know, me protecting you. You know, that's why we get or don't get the measles vaccine. And in that case, I am making that choice. But the problem is, I mean, that isn't where the news is, although there is some information.
And the other thing is, I mean, I agree. I mean, in my heart of hearts, it's a very affirmative bias topic, but at the same time, I mean, there are a lot of people who oppose these kinds of things. Same kinds of people who, like, I don't understand how people could really oppose a national healthcare system, but I guess the autonomy argument is very compelling to a lot of people, and a lot of people write on it.
Well,
but I agree that
things, this is, if I don't get this vaccine, I'm going to get sick. That's, you're not going to get sick if I don't get this vaccine. I'm going to get sick. That's the issue. As compared to other, that's with the H1N1, whereas compared to other things like measles, where if I don't get the vaccine, in fact, you're going to get sick. You know, I mean, there is an absolute difference between these things. So if somebody's saying, okay, I'm going to make you get a vaccine because I don't want you to get sick, it's, well, wait a second. You know, it's me. I get to decide whether I want to get sick or not, because it's not, the contagion issue isn't really the factor so much, at least not some, because of the immunization.
But almost all affirmatives are running arguments about the contagious part, not about the government needs to protect you. It's that the government needs to protect everyone else. I mean, that seems to be where most affirmatives seem to be going. And so to combat that, the negative really has to depend on, I mean, either, you know, some sort of counter plan where they, you know, talk about, you know, well, we should have informed consent, and that'll do enough. We'll get enough herd immunity. We don't need to make it compulsory. But still, when you have the impacts of the affirmative, I mean, a lot of that has to do with, you know, judges just they won't weigh arguments about deontology against arguments about real world people are dying impacts. I mean, it's very difficult to do that. I mean, deep down, I think the negative is right. I think that there's a line. It's the reason why we don't kill people that have communicable diseases now, because there's something sacrosanct about the body that we do not violate no matter what. It's why we don't, you know, it's why we don't do certain things. It's why even if slavery were a beneficial economic system, we ought not have slaves, right? Because there's something, there's some line that the government does not cross no matter what. And
I'm looking at a different idea, which is simply like the measles vaccine. The thing about the measles vaccine is I get this shot and it's a crapshoot, because if it, I could get the measles vaccine and get very, very, very sick from it, I could die.
Right.
Okay, so, or I don't get the measles vaccine and you get very, very, very sick and you die. Now, that is a whole different calculus than any of the other things we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And if that, and frankly, I mean, that to me, I mean, I started thinking about this topic because I go back and I keep talking about this, which was the This American Life show that had that very specific story about measles in California and was making those very specific points. So I hear this and I'm thinking, well, here's an absolutely fantastic example of almost, it's a one-off. It's I die or you die when this needle comes at me. And I'm going, well, I'd rather you die than I die. And, but on the same, you know, but I have some social responsibility. So all of a sudden I hear everything and all the cases that I see that, you know, that I hear about or that my team is running have absolutely nothing to do with any of this whatsoever. So, I mean, we've gone away from what actually is a very fair, you know, negative affirmative, you know, stretch to, and I agree with you. I mean, what sounds to me like an awfully affirmative bias situation.
It's just, it's tough to... I mean, it's tough to, and I guess it's one of the faults of going down the road of empirics and policy debate and things like that, that, you know, arguments such as, you know, deontology and stuff like that. I think that, you know, you get people to vote for slavery on this topic if in LD debate now, if you had the cards to say it was good. Mm-hmm. And because I think that there's just sort of this, there's not a taking seriously of deontological based arguments for one reason or another, and then everyone pulls out their 10-point block about how deontology just reverts to a utilitarian argument and that you need to have life before you can have other things, and you know, all those things sort of, it's hard to overcome that. But if there was a time where people should stick to their guns on deontology, it would be a topic like this, I guess, where, you know, what's at stake is would could be pretty serious. Additionally, you know, it just seems like theory, to some degree, is an easier way out. And I know my own debaters are extremely, I mean, against the wishes of most of their judges, yet they seem to be fairly successful at it, at debating the reverse voter, which says, if you're going to run four theory arguments mm-hmm. against me, if you're going to run four theory arguments against me, all of which I have to beat in order to even have access to my case, and you get to kick out of them whenever you want, I'm going to say that if I prove that I'm theoretically sound, then I win. And, you know, it's been fairly successful for my debaters. I know that a lot of judges in LD debate, only because they hear policy debate people making fun of it, I think, because if you are going to appeal to some sort of fairness for the negative to be able to run all these things and then be able to kick out of whatever they want to pick and choose, if you are going to believe in fairness, you would think that that's unfair. But it seems like a legitimate way to combat that and make the affirmative have to deal – or make the negative have to deal with that too, so that they do have to choose positions that do have some risk in running them and that, you know, have some level of truth to them. It can't just be I'm going to run five theory arguments against you and you have to win all of them even to access your case.
Right.
And so, you know, granted, it took my debaters the entire 2AR to convince judges. They had to literally spend 3 minutes of the 2AR to convince the judges to vote on the reverse voter. But, you know, it worked a few times. And you know, I'd like to see more judges being willing to vote on it.
Well, that that brings my question as you're saying this, and I'm thinking about is what is the position of the voting, the judging universe these days on theory as a whole? I mean, I don't know. I mean, where are we with this as a real? Okay, this is just one more quiver in the one more arrow in the quiver kind of thing.
You know, I don't. Most judges I talk to will say, you know, that they don't like theory arguments. But you know, I don't really know what that means. It seems like if someone has a legitimate theoretical gripe in a debate round, they should be able to make that argument.
I think that the problem is that, and okay, this is going to now really reveal how you know, out of touch I am, I guess, with certain theory arguments. But for me, you know, and I guess as a disclaimer, I used to judge a lot more rounds than I have recently. You know, I've done more tabbing and whatnot than judging a lot of
rounds.
And wandering off. But
mostly people just strike each other.
That's nice. That's probably true. But you know, one problem I had when theory arguments were really starting to creep into LD is that it seemed as though if people were really felt. Well, here are a couple of issues I have. You know, people would say things like, there's no way I can respond to this argument, but theory would be one of the three responses they would make to the argument. So it seems like there were ways they could respond to the argument, right? Or it seemed that they were indicting their opponent for pretty serious offenses and bad things, but then continue to debate the round in other ways. So I've seen really compelling theory things I've seen, and it sounds like your debater Beats did the same thing with the spending a lot of time with this in the two errors, that like, you know, really committing to the theory, I think, demonstrates that there's a serious abuse. Using it as a, you know, another arrow in your arsenal and whatnot, or as just a throwaway argument, I think might be why some people find it to be uncompelling. Because then, in my opinion, it doesn't just sound like whining. It sounds like, you know, something
just
silly.
I didn't mean it that way. I meant that, I mean, one thing. That
no, you, I know what you meant. I know what you meant.
It seems to be right. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if you're going to go with a theory argument, you can't go with anything else. It's like,
oh, that's not true. I don't think that's true.
How does that work? I mean, either the debate is fair and I can argue it, or it isn't fair and I can't argue it. How can there be like, and I'll argue it anyhow?
Well, that's what it is. It's and I'll argue it anyhow. You can say, I'm going to run my negative case, even though my opponent is unfair. I'm still going to run my negative case, and I might have something that a disadvantage to doing the affirmative, but I don't have any, you know, specific on-case evidence about this.
Okay. I guess the response I'm talking about, though, is the specific, and this is why I just always found this argument to be so uncompelling most of the times when it was run, is the, you know, I had no way of predicting that this would be the response, so it's so unfair, so drop it. But here are actually five answers to the case. That kind of answer to me just never.
I mean, I could not be prepared, but
I'm sure some people are listening to this and going, "Oh, Cruz, that's just pathetic that you don't get it with that answer." But to me, that just has never. That kind of answer has never been compelling when it's part of a menu of different things the judge could, you know, theoretically choose from.
But debate's not about being true. It's not. It's we're not finding.
But that argument
T
doesn't even make sense. But I'm not talking about capital T truth. That argument. I'm just talking about that specific argument. I don't know why I'm, you know, bitching so much about that argument. But that particular kind of argument, which debaters make so often, the I couldn't predict this, I have no way of responding to this, here are six other answers to the argument. It's not even about capital T truth. The argument doesn't make sense to me at all if you are, you know, if it's not if you're making tons of responses to the case. That's all I'm talking about, that kind of theory.
Well, I don't know. It's like if you have a debt that you could never pay back, and you go back and you go to the debt to the person that owns the debt and say, "Look, this debt that I owe to you is completely unfair, but because I want to hedge my bet a little bit, here's some money that I'm going to give you because I have this little bit of money, so I know it'll never pay it all back. So first of all, this is an unfair debt, but second of all, here's some money just so that I can hedge my bet."
I think that analogy makes sense with other theory arguments, just not to me with the argument that I wasn't prepared to debate against this, but now I'm going to make a lot of answers.
Well, I don't think anyone says that I wasn't prepared. They would say that it was an unpredictable way to take the resolution, right? Like, my kids ran
but
arguments
I yet have seven
about
answers I can make against.
Sure, because you can make up arguments right on the spot, right? Like you know, okay. when my debaters are running arguments about vaccinating animals.
So then why was the predictability bad, though? That's all I mean. I'm just confused why then that we
well,
should
because
care
they're not,
about
I mean, they're not particularly good. Like, I think that my analogy holds true. Like,
well,
It's all not I'll like say. You're making a dent. You can't really – just because you can put ink against an argument doesn't mean that you have good arguments against it.
This will perhaps cause the remaining debaters who have not struck me to strike me. But I guess I'll just say that in my gut, it seems to me that if you hadn't wasted the time on the bad theory argument, you would have had more time to make better answers.
Well, the bad theory argument is pre-written. You don't waste any time in prep time with your bad theory argument. It's pre-written. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're sitting there racking your brain...
I know, I agree. I know it's pre-written. Yet another reason why you had, you know... I understand the point that you're trying to make. I just think that... I think that there's a... I guess this points to a larger issue. I agree, Beats, that debate is not about capital T truth. I agree that debate should not be the Starbucks philosophy club where we're sitting around, you know, trying to find the meaning of the universe, because that's silly and can't be done in a time-constrained way. But it seems to me at the same time that when we surrender our ability to, like, look at the arguments and understand if arguments make sense and debate, and judges really surrender that entirely. And I'm not saying the judges should insert their opinion, but they should at least be active listeners to what is happening in the round. That, you know, when arguments don't make – when they're just not coherent with one another, it seems to me that that's a problem. And we're doing not just debate a disservice, but the debaters a disservice.
I completely agree. Our judges need to be better. 100%. Our judges need to be holding kids responsible for the types of arguments they're running and not let it just be a completely nihilistic type of judge where you're just like, well, it was said and it wasn't responded to. I think right. that judges do need to evaluate arguments and things like that. That's why we want good, educated judges and not just robots that write X's and O's, right. Because we do want that. But in a world where we shouldn't be blaming kids or coaches for doing these things if judges aren't – if judges
– Oh, well, that I completely agree with. I 100% agree with what you're saying. I think Aaron Timmons actually has made this point very, very well in a couple of posts. Not always about theory, but has talked about that, the central importance of who judges rounds and why – why do judges judge rounds in a certain way? I completely agree with you. And then I think that actually ties back to what Jim was saying earlier. It's like, well, why do debaters have to do this? Well, they have to do it because judges, you know, that the reality is that the judges are going to, you know, are going to listen to certain things and they have to be ready for it.
Yeah, I'm very as I've gotten older, I've become very much less likely to blame the competitor for practices in a round as the judges who allow the practices or reward the practices in the round. You know, it's a competitive activity. And if a judge is going to let you get away with stuff, then
yeah, what wins and people are going
to
do.
Yeah. And it's high stakes. You have to win 4 out of 6 rounds where you spent $1,000 to go to this tournament. It's tough to say, you know, don't do this, you know, especially when judges are willing to vote on it, you know, with some obvious,
I've taken this back to square one. I have a question, which is, okay, I know nothing about theory. How do I find out about theory in the LD world today?
There's actually some pretty good discussions going on in LDDebate.org. Mm-hmm. One that just popped up is about whether or not or what sort of counterplans are being run on this topic. I know that some people are running informed consent counterplan or a incentives where they actually pay people to go get immunized or offer some sort of a tax break to go get immunized. And then the theory debate that takes place is, can the affirmative just say, well, we'll do both? Is that affirmative ground to say we'll do both? You know, theory is more than just about combating weird cases, but it's also what is the role of what does it mean to affirm and what does it mean to negate, and you know it's much larger than just the violations that you see out there, but also what does it mean to what's the role of the resolution, how do burdens work, and what happens if you make impacts of things outside of the burden. I mean, it's nothing that we haven't been debating since, you know, who Time remembers the world. Old, yeah. I mean, ever, if you go back to, you know, the old LD, what was the LDL? The LDL, right?
Yes.
That where people would argue all the time about whether or not the negative could run balanced negs, right? Whether or not that was fair, whether you could say actually, we should do both things. You know,
we never looked at it from a structural point of view. I mean, we just sort of did it or talked about it, but we never took
But it was a huge thing. But it was a huge cultural difference between, you know, different people that came from policy debate would say, well, why not? Why can't the negative just do that? And, you know, there were, I remember at Iowa, it was taught you would never do something like that. You could never run a balanced negative. Eventually, it was sort of said that, well, you can run a balanced negative, but it's not a very good strategy. But why isn't it a good strategy? I mean, it's sort of giving a language to, or a vocabulary to being able to discuss these things. And
for
I don't know.
Somebody like me, I mean, I've been around for a long time, that I know all the stuff, but I don't know what the vocabulary is at the moment. So it's good to have a place to go and someone can talk about it intelligently.
Of course, the only thing I would say is that debaters, I don't blame the debaters, but I do blame coaches and judges for this. Debaters should, of course, remember that having vocabulary to describe things should not replace the importance of having analysis to support those arguments.
Definitely. Absolutely. That is one of my bete noires. Oh, you know,
because, I mean, this is the biggest problem, I think, that this is – or place where this has really had problems in LD has been in weighing, where weighing has just become like, well, it outweighs on magnitude, right? I mean, what the – what? Right? Like, can we have a little context of what that means? And I think that one of the reasons why a lot of judges just detest theory is because a lot of times that is what happens in theory arguments. I mean, I think that it's good – I agree that when theory is good, it is a well developed theory shell. There are warranted reasons for what you're saying, and it's well developed. But a lot of times, it's just very bad shorthand.
Yeah,
very
bad shorthand. The argument is made on the level of, you know, in English as compared to all the jargon, then it's persuasive. I mean, what I read, I mean, what you guys sent me, I mean, certainly not unpersuasive material. It's the point at which it goes into jargon, which anything, it's not just debate, everything does this. It goes into jargon to show off what it is about, but then it's not it anymore.
About
it's about
anything,
it, you know, and there's a big difference between being it and being about it, and we need it in the debate round. So.
And I think that, you know, it's the responsibility of judges to make debaters or hold debaters to what they said, not what they mean to say, and not fill in the gaps for them. Because I think that's where, you know, then the faster debater wins, because they can just throw out a bunch of jargon that the judge will just say, "Oh, I get what they mean by that," right? And I think that is probably
because I go into rounds. You know, I don't judge. I'm like John. I don't judge that much. When I do judge, you're going to have to be kind to me. You can't use shorthand because. I haven't judged 50 rounds a minute ago, so it takes me a while to get back up to speed and stuff like that. You got to be clear. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, when a cross-examination says, well, what's the status of the counterplan, and the negative says, well, it's conditional. I mean, is a layperson going to know what that means at all?
Right.
But there has to be some explanation of you know, what that is.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've beaten that horse to death.
Well, I think it's still alive. I think we could talk
agree. We could talk about. I think it's what I mean. What is interesting is that each resolution has its own theory, stuff.
That's right. LD is a little bit it's. I mean, in policy debate, you sort of have the year to flesh out the theoretical arguments, and by the end, theory has moved on. In LD, we sort of start at point zero. You know, every 2 months. So,
yeah, we'll do it again. All right. Well, we will be back on this subject, I'm sure. It's time for our tech moment.
Tech tip.
Music is playing behind us. I wish I could do this.
The music seriously is so good.
I'm going to be honest. I've never listened to an episode of this show.
That is so rude.
I listened to the beginning, and where I'm going to put the music in the middle and the end. I've never listened to anything other than
listened to how blaring and frankly effeminate my voice sounds in these recordings.
John, that's you what see I everything, to. You every movie you've ever seen, you've seen 27 times. So, of course, you listen to every word about it. We said
27 times. 270 times.
The rest of us just move on. I want to use some more of that Disney music that I used in my opening ceremony of Bump. Anyhow, I want to.
Oh, yeah. Wait a second. That should actually be what the tech tip is, the electronic opening assembly that Bump pioneered. Anyway, sorry. I especially like you giving directions. Now, to my left is X, Y, and Z. That was perhaps the most surreal part of the entire thing.
Well, I want everyone to come to my tournament and plug in their iPods at exactly 3 o'clock. And then we all, okay, everybody listening? Okay, start. Boom. Okay. And then we can, like, go back to the tab room, get all the ballots ready, come out. 3:15, it's over. And, you know, and it's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow. And then, oh, yeah, okay, good. Here's your ballots. That works for me. Anyhow, I want to talk about my favorite thing, which I had last week, but I didn't know if it would be my favorite thing a week later, and it is my favorite thing a week later, which is the Magic Mouse for the Mac. This is the most wonderful thing I've ever had. First of all, it's the sexiest looking mouse ever. You know that, John, you've seen this movie 270 times, The Navigator?
Yes, I have. That's not 270 times, like. But...
That's what this looks like, that kind of streamline. Oof, I don't want to touch it because of all kinds of things will happen. Streamline, you know, it's got the Bluetooth. You just sort of look at it and it knows what to do. It goes to the next page. It's just, I cannot recommend this highly enough.
I've been on the search for it. I've called all 10 Apple stores in the Los Angeles, Ventura County, Orange County area, and it cannot be found.
Really?
Cannot be found. And I called them the last 3 days. I've been on the search for the Magic Mouse because I desperately want one. And, you know, with the Magic Mouse, I thought, okay, I'm not going to go. Because whenever something new, I'm the first to go out and buy it.
Yeah, I know. You definitely are.
And I said, I'm going to exercise some self-control here, and I'm not going to go buy it, and this is what I get.
I'm a fan of the old mouse that a lot of people didn't like, but this
I like
one,
the old mouse. So this thing looks like the Trimaxian drone ship from the Flight of the Navigator.
Yes.
We're talking about the Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah,
okay.
Flight of the Navigator. Right? The Trimaxian. How do you know? You did see it 270 times.
Actually, I have to admit, any mouse. I am unfamiliar with the design of this. I'm going to look it up as we speak. But the Trimaxian drone ship, if I had a mouse like that, I'd be pretty happy.
Okay. It has that. It's not like a little lumpy thing. It's really an interesting thing. But the whole gestures thing. I mean, I have the new Mac.
Wow.
It does the gestures, but this thing does. I mean, even more.
All right.
Intuitive.
Breaking news from New York, New York. It does look like a Trimaxian drone ship. I am very pleased.
I was a big fan of Flight of the Navigator, so. Get one of these. Well, you can't get one of these things, but...
Did that movie have puppets?
It had, like, I think kind of, like, pioneering 3D animation in parts of it. It probably did have puppetry in it, too.
All it had was that thing that, you know, kept sticking in his head. I mean, you know, the...
It's about a kid that is that has a spaceship or something,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, Pee-wee Herman. The spaceship was Pee-wee Herman.
What?
The spaceship was Pee-wee Herman. It was Pee-wee Herman. Wow, it's just like Star Tours. He's the robot in Star Tours, or the droid in Star Tours. Mm-hmm. He's the voice of the ship. He's Penguin's father. Who knew? Okay, anyway. Sorry.
Well, I won't even go in down. I won't say what I was going to say. There's children in the audience. Anyhow, I do recommend the Magic Mouse. What is, John, you have to be able to predict something about the tournament.
Oh, so predictions. First off, I'm going to make... I'm going to make 2.5 bump predictions. These need to be made. The first one is a half prediction because there won't be an opening assembly, but I do predict that Jim Menick will manage to whisper the names of all the people who have won different awards. Now, for those of you who don't know, the HenHud, all debate events at HenHud, the gathering area is the cafeteria, which is perhaps even worse acoustically than the classrooms of the Bronx High School of Science. And Menick has over the years decided that it is no longer worth raising his voice, but it's also apparently no longer worth getting a microphone. So you have to – it is a really surreal experience. And when Doug Jeffers first came up to the bump tournament, I said – I kept telling him it's going to be the ultimate whisper. And Doug told me afterwards, he goes, you were right. Now, related to that, I have 3 other predictions. This is the bump special, okay? Mm-hmm. I predict that I will be wearing two distinct Argyle sweater vests, which I am breaking out my traditional sweater vest look in honor of the bump tournament. I also predict that you will see a epically large traveling fruit cup can as the top speaker award. Now, for those of you who know, the top speaker award at Bump is a can. In the past few years, it has been a soup can. Apparently, in the past, before my time, it was a fruit cup can. Yes, and then Hunter College opened it up and ate it. That's a little nasty, but
well, we never saw them again after that.
But Noel Salesi did directly admit to this crime in an email to me when the other day when I was asking for the really old speaker top speaker names. But the new award has been completed. There'll be a picture of it soon on VBD. The final prediction is that, and this is one of the reasons I love working at the Bump Tournament, I get to work with the novices in the novice tab. And it's very adorable because for the novices, this is their first overnight tournament for the most part. So it's a really big event for the novices in our area. Every single possible mistake a novice could make at a tournament will happen. There will be a novice who goes to debate the wrong round. There will be a novice who cries before housing. There will be a novice who just gets lost. And there will be a novice who goes over to the varsity building to debate. That was my favorite error last year. So I will do the. I will handle this all with a big smile on my face. Jim Menick will never hear a complaint about it because I love it. But that those are my predictions. Sorry, that was a little long-winded, but they needed to be made, those predictions.
I predict that the tournament will end. Or I hope that the tournament will end.
I do actually want to say one thing. I sort of chickened out the week before my own tournament and said I was just too busy to host or to come and participate in a view from the tab. And I think it's pretty cool that Menick is so calm the days before his tournament that he could do this.
As a matter of fact, the strikes just shut down while we were talking. Ooh. 9 o'clock tonight, there'll be no more strikes.
Okay, now I don't know if this is going to be the case when we record it, but Jim Menick's voice just turned into a robot voice there for a moment. Skype was a little weird.
The difference between the Skype and the going into GarageBand, is different. I'm off tomorrow, so I will get all the data will be massaged. It's within an inch of its life, and I'm ready.
Excellent. Cool. Beats, are you going to a tournament this weekend?
I will be at the Damien debates
with
NFL Hall of Fame member Chuck Ballingall. Last weekend we had USC.
David Damus Trojan Championships.
That is correct, the Trojan Championships.
Nice.
On the very proud USC campus.
Excellent.
Hosted by the Annenberg School.
Ryan Hamilton made sure to remind me during the tournament that he had once won that tournament. Apparently he was helping you in tab.
The funny thing about Ryan Hamilton is that after he won the USC tournament the next year it lost its TOC bid. And then when he went bid hunting...
Yeah, this is true. This is the best part.
And went to the Vestavia Hills tournament, got to the quarterfinal round, got his bid. The next year became a semis bid tournament.
Some people have the touch. Hello, Ryan. On that note, we will sign off, and I guess we'll see everybody next week. Okay, take care.
Good night.
Good night.